This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and this show is called The People Behind the PhDs. This is Dr. Z, Zachary Brooks, and welcome to part two of the interview with Dr. Mark Whiting, who combines design and computation to build systems that augment our collective psychologies and philosophies at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. There's a few seconds of overlap, so we can pick up right where we left off in The People Behind the PhDs.
Lego, in particular, Lego Technic, which is sort of the technical variety of Lego, very much from being, you know, a very young child for quite a while.
I still like that, if that's okay. I still like those.
yeah, no, they're great. But yeah, I use them a lot to sort of build things, like solutions to problems. I also worked, I did some robotics competitions in high school and so on. And, you know, I didn't mind, I really enjoyed an aspect of that, which is the sort of the technical side. But I think often those scenarios miss out on the sort of humanitarian side, or even, you know, what makes something aesthetically interesting. And so just for a little context, as I mentioned before, my father is a physicist. So he comes with this very technical frame, thinking about, you know, what makes the world work or what makes the universe work. And my mother is an archaeologist. So she comes with a very sort of human-focused frame, thinking about why people do what they do or did what they did, based on the things that they left behind. And so I've often had this very sort of specific view of how the things that we have and use can influence who we are. And, you know, that obviously comes from, is strongly inspired by this perspective of archaeology. And then on the other side, sort of the implementation and the technical mastery of it, I think, or the technical sort of viewpoint, as it comes more from my father's perspective.
Yeah, some sort of applied archaeology perspective or something.
Yeah.
Wow, that's fantastic. So you did your studies in Australia, and I read online you did both your bachelor's and a master's degree in Australia. Is that correct?
No. So I did a bachelor's in Australia, and 1 year of that I spent in China as an exchange student.
Okay.
And then after my bachelor's, I was working as a consultant for a little while. And then I did a master's in Korea at KAIST.
Okay.
And that was also in industrial design.
So before we get to Korea, what brought you to China? I mean, you were just an undergrad and thought, gosh, I want to study abroad because I like to live in different places. Or was there a reason you went to China? Was it there to go to learn something in particular, or what was your kind of thought process to go to China?
So I went to our guidance counselor, or whatever they call them, I forget what title that is, but the person who's supposed to sort of help coordinate this kind of stuff. And I had wanted to, you know, spend a year abroad. Many of my friends were doing that, so I thought it would be fun. And I said to them, I want to go somewhere where I might get shot at. And they said, look, we don't have any places that we think you're going to get shot at. And if we did think that, we wouldn't send you. So they weren't excited by that. But they did offer a few other options that they thought would be exciting and that we had sort of a potential relationship with from an academic standpoint.
And, you know, it would have been funnier if they would have said, you know what, we have just the place.
I agree. That would have been very funny.
Yeah.
But they'd... And I probably would have gone.
You probably would have gone, but they said, well, you know, a backstopped or, you know, a second best option is going to China.
Well, they offered the sort of most exciting places that I could think of out of their list of options were either to go to Peru or to China. And I liked both of those. I looked closely at both, and it ended up that the Peru option wasn't going to work for some academic reasons.
Okay.
So I went to China, and it happened to be that I was actually the first person to do this from my school.
Oh.
So they didn't have an exchange program, and that caused all sorts of problems. but it also let me have a lot of flexibility and, you know, have a lot of experiences that I think otherwise would have been curtailed or limited.
Okay.
So yeah, that was very enjoyable.
Where in China did you study?
I was at Zhejiang University, which is in Hangzhou, China, which is about 2 hours from Shanghai. Although now they have a faster train, so now it's like 35 minutes. But when I lived there, it was about 2 hours from Shanghai.
So to orient people who don't have the Chinese map in front of them, so Shanghai's in the east coast, but it's still considered north, is that correct? Or is it central east?
This is a complicated matter of perspective. many people would say that Shanghai is South China, but let's just say that it's on the East Coast and it's, you know, approximately halfway down.
Okay, and then you were 2 hours away from Shanghai then?
Yeah, so I was 2 hours inland from Shanghai.
Got it, okay.
So Shanghai is just above a river delta, and where that river delta enters the mainland is where Hangzhou is.
Okay, got it. So that's Hangzhou, that's where you were studied for a year. And you returned to Australia, you finished your bachelor's degree, you worked as a consultant. Were you in Australia at the time and still in Melbourne or what?
I was traveling a lot.
Okay.
I did work in Europe and Asia and various other places. But yeah, and it was sort of mostly design and strategy related for a little while.
Okay, excellent. So then what was the thought process then to do a master's in Korea? And obviously this Korean Advanced Institute of Science and Technology is very well known, but certainly within academic circles is an excellent place. But what brought you to KAIST?
Yeah, so the truth of this is sort of strange. When I lived in China, I had a lot of really good Korean friends because they often go there to study Chinese in order to do business with the Chinese.
Okay.
And so I made a lot of friends in that community, as well as, of course, in the Chinese community. But I made these Korean friends who I wanted to, you know, visit. And I was traveling around, and this was in 2008, traveling around. And then the economy went really bad. And so I had been working as a consultant, and I just was having a really hard time getting new clients. Even many of my big clients who, you know, had signed up for multi-year contracts, basically had to kill huge projects and so on.
What kind of consulting work were you doing, Mark?
In China, it was in innovation procurement, helping companies who are interested in getting innovation resources from a place like China and buying or funding them such that they could steer them to help in a project in an international setting.
Okay, got it. Stories are humanity's original technology, so I'm proud to carry on the traditional technology and share this story with you. Whether you're on an iPhone or an Android, whether you're on Apple, Spotify, or another podcast service, whether you're at home, in your car, at work, on public transportation, working out, or just walking around, I dedicate my shows to you. Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts, Consequential Stories for Life. So it's 2008, the economy's not going well. You're losing your clients, even your multi-year clients. And then at this point, what's your thought process?
So I'm visiting Korea, hanging out with some friends, and I was thinking about maybe doing a master's. And I visited two universities in Korea that had interesting master's programs. One was KAIST and one was Hongik University, which is another school famous for its industrial design. I also visited some other schools, so I looked at some schools in America and in Europe. KAIST seemed really fun and had a very strong reputation. And I had always enjoyed being in Korea, so I thought it would be really nice to go back there and do school. So it wasn't a particularly in-depth thought process.
Okay.
It was sort of a spur-of-the-moment thing that ended up being quite defining.
So was the word that sort of captured the moment something like, sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, the market was going poorly, and I thought a master's was sort of a good alternative to trying to work in that market, which it was. And again, one of the big benefits of the Korean option versus, for example, a master's in the United States is that KAIST provides a government scholarship to many of its international students. So again, this was a degree that I didn't need to pay for.
Wow, fantastic.
And in fact, I got a stipend to be there.
That's incredible. So what did you study industrial design again, but at the master's level in Korea then?
That's correct.
Okay.
And it's important to know that this is a different kind of industrial design, but yeah, that's not too important, but it's sort of a more scientific environment.
Well, so for me, people who are listening who don't know what industrial design is, can you give them a short definition and then what it was in Australia and then what it was in Korea, just to orient people a little bit?
So industrial design is what makes Apple products so vibrant. It's the process of turning a human need into a beautiful and effective solution that involves usually a very artfully and thoughtfully designed physical form, and often also a thoughtfully and artfully designed interaction or service model. So in Australia, my industrial design program was sort of older world, so it was much more about the physical form, and it was also very conceptual. So we did a lot of sort of philosophizing about what good design might be and how that might work.
Okay.
In Korea, on the other hand, it was a very much more human-computer interaction-oriented program. So there was a lot of discussion of how we should design interfaces or how interfaces could be improved over time. And it was very scientific. So this is a master's program, and it's in a master's program at a highly technical university. In fact, KAIST models itself after MIT.
Okay.
You know, many of their programs are designed to compete directly with MIT.
Okay. And so Korea is obviously, so people don't know, Korea is known for an incredible gaming culture. They have some of the highest speed internet
in
the world. So, you know, it would make sense that they're actually very fascinated with this human, you know, for an outsider at least, and human computer interaction kind of things.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, a big part of this was sort of running experiments on people or with people to understand how things should be designed to work better for them. And that, you know, that was a core part of this program.
Okay. So at some point, though, you finish up and then you start thinking about a PhD at this time, or what was your thought process then?
Yeah, so again, I worked for a year. I worked in a medical device company. Designing, you know, medical devices. And around that time, I thought doing a PhD could be interesting. And so I applied for one and started that at Carnegie Mellon.
Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the United States.
Yeah.
And then what was the, I looked it up earlier, what was your PhD in at Carnegie Mellon?
So it was in mechanical engineering, which is kind of a sidestep. But my advisor had a focus on understanding sort of how design is done within the engineering context. And in particular, he had a focus on doing this computationally. So a lot of the work that I did there was in computational design, thinking about how we can make design decisions using computational systems, for example. And that's sort of how I spent my time for several years before coming here.
So can you give us an example of computational design that sort of commercially or from a consumer perspective, relevant or understandable, what computational design is?
Yeah, sure. So there's a very simple and intuitive example, which is that many years ago, to get a good photo, you'd have to spend a lot of time in Photoshop or some similar program, you'd have to do a lot of custom filters and a lot of careful things. Nowadays, we have many cameras that do this automatically, right? They computationally decide what the best things to make bright or make dark are. And then on top of that, we have a lot of apps like Snapchat or like Instagram that give us filters. And so suddenly we can take this image and with just a few quick steps, we can get this very specific and nuanced figure out that we prefer. So computational design in general is the same idea, but maybe applied to many other kinds of things that we built. So an example where it's often used is in designing houses, because there's many parts of the house that are very similar, and you don't necessarily want to make all the decisions to make about that part every time. So if you're like putting in a window in a house, and you're sketching this in the 3D program that lets you design houses, you might sort of build some rules that lets you do that automatically. And that's an example of this.
Okay, so that computational design, that the idea captures, you know, the tens and thousands of processes that have gone into changing and improving things as well. That's part of it, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. So it's often how things are improved. It's really like how we can quantify many of the nuanced aspects that go into deciding what something should be like. And in some cases, we quantifying it makes it much more automatable. Not in all cases, and that's sort of one of the nuances that we study. But like in some cases, we can do things much more automatically, and that's usually very helpful.
So when you were at Carnegie Mellon, obviously you said you shifted a little bit to mechanical design, but what were your inspirations there? Because, you know, doing a PhD, you're forced to, you know, forced is not the right word, but you're compelled and you're put in situations mm-hmm. where you're drawn into new circles and new thought processes, and sometimes those happenstance moments can really change your PhD and intellectual trajectory. Did you have any moments at Carnegie Mellon you thought, wow, this is something really unique and exciting, I want to pursue further?
Not exactly, actually.
Okay.
In some ways, I kind of knew what I was going to do, or at least I was aware of the things that I ended up doing quite well, or to a quite strong degree. So for many years, I'd been interested in basically getting better at design. And, you know, like we make design decisions, like we might make something one color or a different color when we're making a new product. But a lot of the decisions we make are not based on really good data. They're just based on somebody sort of flipping a coin and saying what they prefer.
Thanks for listening to part two of the interview with Dr. Mark Whiting, who researches how to improve decision making and coordination at individual, team, and societal scales. To continue listening, visit drz.net. That's dr-z.net. You can also follow me on Facebook at Dr. Z Podcasts and Instagram at drznet. As always, happy deciding. The People Behind the PhDs is conceived, written, produced, and edited by Dr. Z, that's me, Zachary Brooks, PhD, in Dr. Z Productions and Podcasts. Learn more at drz.net/about. That's dr-z.net/about.